Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning, the 16th of March. Very nice to have you with us. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. Let me introduce the group to you. We also welcome you to join our conversation. It's simple to do. All you have to do is write to us. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. Simple as that. Let me introduce the group. We go to Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Well, I'm very interested in what's going on. You know, we saw yesterday, and WAMC reported on it at length, the new numbers that Cuomo is getting. And, you know, I've been telling you, Joe, and I think it's worth just mentioning, that I've been getting a lot of telephone calls, pro-Cuomo telephone calls. And what's extraordinary about that is that there were people who didn't believe it. Now out comes the poll, and it's clear he's doing extremely well. I don't think this is an endorsement by any means, but it is interesting that there are an awful lot of people out there who are not listening to the so-called political practitioners.
Slightly more than a third of voters, 35%, said they believed the governor had committed sexual harassment, while 24% believed he had not, according to the poll. It was conducted in the second week of March. We'll get into it a little bit more, but it is interesting results, certainly. And I think in a let's say, 3 weeks of really bad news for the governor, he could at least perhaps take solace in the numbers in this report. We'll talk about that. But half of New York voters say he should not resign, as Alan mentioned. We'll get into that in a moment. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm joining you from Virginia, where newly vaccinated, my mother and I have come to visit my granddaughter. And interestingly, it is a state where their governor was once under extreme pressure from his own and the opposing party to resign after a picture of him in blackface surfaced. And he is still the governor, he maintained, and that appears to be the policy that Andrew Cuomo is following, at least until a statewide investigation is concluded.
More on that. Good to have you from Virginia. And, well, good to have you from anywhere. But, yeah, Virginia's nice, too. Hopefully you're warm. Teresa Bourgeois is with us as well. She is Cohoes City Director of Operations and our good friend. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Delightful to be here, and happy day before St. Patrick's Day, Joe.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, St. Patrick's Day is tomorrow, and today is the 16th. And if I knew my feast days better, I'd know who it's for, but I don't. I used to. I don't anymore. St. Joseph's Day is the 19th. Anyway, former Times Union Associate Editor, Times Union Associate Editor,
Mike.
My former altar boy friend, he'll know. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I actually do not know who is being feted today, but tomorrow, yes, absolutely, St. Patrick. And then again, 2 days later, the patron saint of Italy, Saint Joseph. Italy's going through a tough time right now, so a lot of, and I even read that Ireland is starting to lock back down.
Yes,
we'll probably talk about all that.
We'll talk about the European lockdowns too. Yeah, Saint Urho, who saved the Finnish grape crops from a frog or grasshopper plague.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
That's the opening act for St. Patrick.
How do you do that, Joe? Boy, you come up with a fast.
Here we go. All right, so now that we've solved that mystery, what's to stop us as we move forward today? Let's get started on the news. Thank you, all panelists. Wonderful to have you here, as always. And we go to, let's go with the Cuomo poll. It seems as good a place to start as any. As Alan mentioned, a Siena College poll showed that more than a third of voters believe that Governor Andrew Cuomo committed sexual harassment, and a slight majority wanted someone else to run for governor next year. And so the numbers are a little bit so this is a survey. We'll just get all this stuff out of the way. But in a survey of 805 registered New York State voters, 57% said they were satisfied with how Mr. Cuomo had addressed the allegations.
How many? What percentage?
57% were satisfied.
5-7, yes, that's right.
5-7.
Said that for emphasis, yeah.
Yes. 32% said they were not. 50% said he should not resign, while 35% said he should. Nearly half said they believed he could continue to do his job effectively as governor, with 34% saying he could not. Even so, the governor's favorability rating has plummeted to one of the lowest points of his decade-long tenure. 43% of voters said they had a favorable opinion of the governor, down from 56% last month. I mean, that is a drop, Alan.
No question. That's a drop. And, you know, he's got to be suffering with that. However, when you take a look, Joe, at what the prospects for a future election would be, it's interesting. I'm sure he's taking some solace out of these results. People don't want him to run another time, but who do they want to run?
Right. And the other point of this poll, and I think it's probably a minor one, but it was taken before the majority of Democrats in the New York congressional delegation, including Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, on Friday called the governor for the governor to step down. But there were still many calls for him to resign prior to, as this poll was being taken. So, Mike, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting to me that Democrats and just the general public don't want to see Cuomo bounced out. Perhaps, I mean, I think a big factor here might be that people saw that Republicans just repeatedly exonerated Donald Trump. They did it twice, despite the overwhelming evidence of impeachable conduct. And back in 2016, after the Access Hollywood tape surfaced, they continued to support him, and they supported him again in the most recent election. And that's after all that information came out about extramarital affairs and payoffs to women he had had affairs with, allegedly. And then what about, you know, that woman, E. Jean Carroll?
Yeah.
She accused, and quite specifically accused the president of having raped her. And he denies it. But, I mean, those seem to not have hurt Trump. So maybe people are saying, well, what Cuomo did wasn't anything close to that. Why should he quit? You know,
right.
I'm wondering if there's like a, you know, a that kind of thing going on. And don't you think it'll be awkward if he does survive this when he gets around to all the other Democrats that have called for his stepping down?
It'll be an awkward state convention, I would think. Yes.
Yeah.
I do want to, Alan, just go back to this real quick.
Please.
I mean, the other big issue here, of course, is the nursing homes. A large number of voters, 60% of them, said that they approved of the coronavirus pandemic response of the governor. However, 66% said they did not approve of the way that his administration handled data related to nursing home deaths.
For good reason.
Absolutely. But it didn't impact their overall favorability, which is interesting.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's going to be fascinating to watch what the establishment does here. They have put their keisters on the line, no question about it. And they are unified in calling for, you know, his ouster, or many of them are anyway. So now that the people get to speak in a poll and it doesn't seem to be going their way, there must be a little bit of shivering going on, don't you think?
How much shivering, Teresa?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of shivering. I think that 41% of the respondents said that they were unsure if he had committed sexual harassment or not. I think the key here is that in all of these cases, women should be heard. The case should be investigated. The investigation is underway. We'll see what happens with the outcome of the investigation. It won't come for a while. But I think the critical question in terms of how he is going to react and how other politicians are comes in the next 14 days when the budget needs to be negotiated. And also what's happening now is that the state is about to receive billions of dollars in funds for the rescue package. And how is that going to get controlled? How is that going to get handled? Will the Assembly and Senate leadership and membership have more or less say in that, because typically, you know, Cuomo controls as much of that funding as he possibly can. So I think we'll see, and what really matters to the public is how the state's governed, and we're going to see in the next 14 days is if it's governed any differently, any more cooperatively or not.
Let's go to Rosemary.
Well, I think that the good news in this poll for Cuomo is that he is going to be in place in the immediate future. There was danger, as these calls mounted for his resignation, that he could not survive the time needed to complete, as Teresa said, the investigations, and that will be a while. I think now it's plain he's going to be there. The biggest threat to him, though, the bigger threat, is those investigations. Letitia James is no slouch. She's put two incredibly strong investigators on the case. And there appears to be a lot there that he has to answer for. So what happens when that investigation comes out? He's certainly far, far, far from being in the clear. But I don't see him being railroaded out. The second factor in all of this is replacement. It's kind of nuts to say, oh, he can't really do his job now because he's under pressure from all these investigations, and then say, in his place, we will put fill in the blank. I haven't heard any name in there that's better than Andrew Cuomo, even under pressure. And so his short-term difficulty is solved, but he's still in a world of trouble.
Mm. Rosemary, that was a very good analysis, I thought. What do you think the possibility here is of the impeachment going forward and kicking him out?
I think the impeachment in New York will run into the same trouble that the Donald Trump impeachment in Washington ran into, which is, it's how can you impeach before you have the information, before you have all of the whole scene in front of you? And they don't. And so, again, I think they're going to be under a lot of pressure to just hold off until the attorney general comes and weighs in. So, again, the threat comes from the attorney general's investigation, not from anything else.
I thought it was interesting that the president finally spoke out, President Biden spoke out on Sunday night, and he said that the investigation should play out and go through its course. It was interesting. Obviously, the two are friendly and friends and very close politically. So then yesterday, there was a little bit of backlash within the White House press room and saying that with all of these others coming forward, why would the president say not call for his immediate resignation? To which Jen Psaki said that the kind of sidestepped it and said that the president found the accusations to be very troubling and concerning and something to watch. And I don't know if that was that a duck? Or a take back, Mike, do you think? What?
Yeah, I mean, she's very, very artful in her finessing of the words and well-suited for the difficult job she has. And I think he's putting his finger up, the president, I mean, he'll put his finger up and test the winds. But look at it. The Senate Majority Leader, the most powerful Democrat in New York other than Andrew Cuomo, Chuck Schumer, was part of that whole thing on Friday.
Right.
I just wonder who organized all that. I mean, somebody had it all happened within minutes, it seemed like. You know, Congress members from all over the state did it, and then Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer did it. If it sounds, and I'm speculating, I don't know this at all, it sounds like Schumer was, I mean, it couldn't have happened without Schumer's blessing. Perhaps he was even orchestrating it. He's one of the ones who orchestrated the ouster of Al Franken. You know, he kind of pulled all the information together and kind of put the pressure on, too, you know, according to extensive reports on it. So, I mean, he seems to be taking the smack down. Let's clear this out. Let's show that we're ready to reject all this behavior. And the president doesn't back him. So, I mean, it's kind of an interesting, awkward situation going on. And watching it play out is fascinating and painful.
Alan, in your it certainly is painful. Alan, in your talk with Paul Tonko, Congressman Paul Tonko, yesterday, did he mention how the call came?
How the call came. What he did mention is his position, which is that there should be a resignation. He did not say that anybody. I did not ask him, and he didn't respond that any pressure was put on him.
Yeah. It is interesting. I agree with you, Mike. It's fascinating to see who would be behind it. And Rosemary, even if someone is behind it, what's the rationale? You clear the decks, to your point, for what?
Well, you know, I think that I want to say that I think that Biden is in a bit of a bind here because he came out so strongly and said, look, if there's any even hint of toxic environment, of harassment, you're out of my office. But, you know, the governor does not work for him. And what Biden is trying to do is to change the atmosphere in the offices he controls, to set up a place where behavior like the kind we're describing and alleging is not tolerated, even a hint of it. That's not the same situation that Cuomo is in. Cuomo it controlled the atmosphere, and if it's toxic, he has to answer for it. But it's not up to Biden to do it. I think that he gets in trouble because we in politics and those following politics want a simple answer. You said this, and therefore you must do that. But it's more nuanced than that. And I think Biden is played it exactly right. Again, I'm not a big fan of his, and he is no supporter of women's rights, as we know from the Clarence Thomas hearings. And yet, I think he played this right. It's I'm not going to tolerate it, and we're going to wait and see what the investigation shows, and if Cuomo's proven to have done what is alleged, then he will pay a price then. So when you look at it, there's not really hypocrisy there.
Sure. There may be
Rosemary, Alan.
No,
sorry.
Go ahead. Only have about a minute, though, but go ahead, Teresa.
We can go ahead.
I just have to disagree with the notion that President Biden is not a supporter of women's rights. I mean, certainly with those hearings, that was a serious problem. But I think if you look at his overall record and just look what he's done in his selection of his cabinet, of the staff that he surrounds himself, look at the legislation. And so I just want to take exception to the notion that President Biden is not a supporter of women's rights. I just disagree with that.
Exception noted. Exception noted. I do think he's done a lot to try to make up for it, but there is still a man who has served over 20 years and has more time there, who has had huge control, much more even than a president, over the rights of women and reproductive rights. And Biden played a major part in getting him there. That's a huge sin to compensate for.
We'll take a break and be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Mike Spain making up the group. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have letters from Russ, who says, we have a letter from Russ. We have many letters, but we have one from Russ, who says, at this point, Cuomo's budget priorities will have all the weight of an upstate assemblyman's request. With four boroughs voting as a block, we can expect a very different set of state funding allocations passed this year. Alan, go ahead.
Well, I would disagree with that, Alan. I think you could probably reference Silver versus Pataki. I mean, the governor even now has enormous power in the budget
process.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely so. But I do think that the budget is going to go a lot faster and smoother than anybody had thought. Obviously, Cuomo is in a bad spot right now. And to some degree, he's got to give at this stage. It's probably a good thing for New York.
Teresa, you were going to say?
No, I agree. I think that I think we'll see a different budget process this time, and I think that will be possibly a good thing. I also think that Senator Schumer delivered an enormous amount of funding for New York State in this stimulus package, and he's got to be concerned about how that is managed. And
it's
just enormous amounts of funding.
It's only $12.5 billion coming to the state when
only.
When Cuomo claiming that it, that the deficit is something like $17 billion. However, there are many who disagree, like the Empire Center, that say it's more like $6 or $8 billion. You know, it's a big debate every year. How really big, how big is the budget deficit really?
And, we don't know. And that credibility, that lack of credibility really has hurt. We heard $16 billion, then we heard nothing, then we heard $12 billion. You know, I mean, it's all over the place. Let me just say one thing about Schumer. Schumer is a brilliant politician, but he's extraordinarily sensitive. When I've been critical of him, and I was, because I didn't think when he was the minority leader he was playing the kind of role, out front role that he should have been. I heard from his staff who said, come on now, you know, this kind of stuff. So now he takes a very tough position with Cuomo, and unlike him, really. So his neck is on the line to some degree, and he's got to be aware of that, too. Maybe we'll see something like, oh, just kidding, who knows? Because he's...
Teresa, and then Rosemary. Go ahead. Go ahead, Teresa.
The Buffalo News today has a summary of the overall spending for New York State in this bill, according to Schumer's office. And, you know, $22 billion in stimulus checks, $21.7 billion in unemployment benefits, $12.6 billion in direct aid to the state, $10.8 billion for counties, $9 billion for schools, $7 billion for the transit, $4 billion for vaccination, $2.6 billion for colleges and universities, $1.8 billion for child care grants, and interesting, an additional $1 billion for Medicare funding because of the way the state does its whole Medicare program, larger than most other states. So, yes, it's $12.6 billion in direct state aid, but there's a lot more than that for the state, and it will be very important how that gets spent. And does it get spent wisely? Because much of this are one shots. And so this next couple of weeks, couple of months are really critical to the longer term economy of the state.
Rosemary or Matt?
I have questions from the state government experts on this panel, of which I am not one. How exactly is Cuomo crippled by his new political words in the budget process? In other words, what is it that he wants or doesn't want that all the other Democrats do about which you foresee problems, and especially Schumer? Are Schumer and Cuomo really at odds over anything big in this budget? I'm not aware of it.
Nothing that I see. I don't think it has to do with it being at odds over things in the budget. I think it has to. This is personal. This is the gunfight at the OK Corral. And I think because Cuomo has been not nice to anyone, these chickens are all coming home to roost right now. I really don't think that it's an issue of, a policy issue. And by the way, you know, being somewhat of a cynic that I am,
only somewhat.
Yeah, you know, one has to just guess about what the Schumer Cuomo politics are here. When it looked like Cuomo was on top and really riding high, he was pretty tough about Schumer and about the congressional delegation doing what they needed to do to protect New York. He was anything but positive about that. I'm sorry, Joe, did I miss something, some nuance there?
No, why?
Oh no, I just like...
No, not at all. Mike, so your answer to...
No, I just quickly, I was going to say, if he does survive this, if Governor Cuomo survives all this and stays in office beyond the investigations, et cetera, he doesn't owe anybody anything. He's like completely free. Now, he has a lot of enemies, obviously, and not that many friends, if any.
And deservedly so, yeah.
Right. Did you see the quote in the New York Times Sunday by Richard Ravitch? It said, the problem with Cuomo is no one has ever liked him. He's not a nice person, and he doesn't have any friends.
I saw it.
Ravitch
ought to take a look in the mirror.
I know. But the point is, he'll come out of this, if he comes out of this and stays in office, he doesn't owe anybody any favors. You know, he can do anything he wants.
But the question is, how will he respond? I mean, the bottom line is these people need to figure out a way to get along so that the business gets done. And will he, I don't think he's crippled in any way, Rosemary, but will he work with folks or will he be even more vindictive? They have to figure out some way to get along, at least for the next few weeks, to get through this budget cycle.
The only person that I know of who has a real potential to benefit is the mayor of New York City, who has had an ongoing low-level war with Cuomo, and now he has, it would seem to me, more standing with other Democrats to get what he wants help directed towards that very beleaguered city. New York City was so hard hit by the pandemic that is that really a bad thing?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. It's so interesting that you talk about that because, as you know, if you read not only between the lines, but on the lines, and remember that de Blasio, the mayor of New York, is term limited. He's out of there. And now he and his people are talking about him running for governor. Now, that'd be an interesting, that, right? Wouldn't that be an interesting,
thing? Maybe Andrew Cuomo won't run for re-election if he gets through this and run for mayor of New York. It's something his father never achieved. But wanted it.
Yeah.
He did.
Interesting. All right. We do have letters. Let's go back to those. Frank says, what is more important, the potentially valid claims of sexual misconduct of a handful of people or the continued push out of this pandemic and economic collapse, especially in the light of the stimulus and upcoming budget negotiations? Answer, simplest trolley experiment ever. Let him do his job, which most think he's doing well. He won't run again, and we can burn him at the stake later. Well, we don't know that he won't run again.
You know, I think I would have to agree with the letter writer. He might run again, which would be a great time for a sort of decent, middle-of-the-road Republican to come in and run against him. And there are some. The one that I know is doing a terrific job at Siena, right, is Chris Gibson. And he wanted to run for governor, creeps in the Republican Party said, no, we want to run another bum, and they did. So you could find such a person, and he could be in real political danger, Cuomo.
Kevin writes and says that the working atmosphere in Albany was and is as toxic as it is being revealed. The lack of all the other state employees who have never spoken up about it shows the fear they must have about keeping their jobs. It should not fall to victims once they have had enough abuse to be the ones to speak up. Then we go.
Well, that's a good letter, and it points out that there really is a problem in New York state government and that people are ruled by fear. And we have heard it again and again and again, and Cuomo's got to own that.
I was going to bring this up, but Bobby asks about it. Elise Stefanik is selling anti-Cuomo merchandise on her campaign website. Great article in the Post Star today. It is. Could she be any bigger of a hypocrite? Stefanik goes on to accuse Biden of covering up for Cuomo, saying Biden should demand Cuomo to resign. Seditionist Stefanik has zero credibility. It's the whole thing about women are scared and being in a room with him and so forth. And obviously the Trump connection there is not lost on many.
Ugh. She opposing her is one reason to be for Andrew Cuomo, I have to say. If Elise is against him, then I want to be for him. She's just giving me visceral reactions lately.
She has no standing in this conversation.
What do you mean? Why does she have
in the
no
conversation
standing?
About Cuomo? She has no standing in that conversation, given that, given her support for
Trump?
Donald Trump. I mean, yeah,
you're right.
Not credible in the conversation.
You're right, but not about her not about her constituency. Those people love her. And that's what's so extraordinary about this. So what they do, this and Rosemary, this goes to your always point about gerrymandering. They put all of those people in one district. They said, okay, yep. We don't want them polluting everything else. So we'll put them all up there. And now they're all for her.
I keep saying that the census is going to save us, no matter how that gets resolved. New York is probably losing districts. That means redrawing the lines. And Stefanik is, I hope, going to get it. The other thing
I don't
is
think
that
so.
Blacks, No. Yeah. Well, okay. The other, let me make my other point is that blacks still are widely in support of Cuomo, and they don't like, for good reason, Elise Stefanik. So her, again, her opposition to him will only harden his advocacy by people downstate in New York and among blacks. So good. You keep pushing that merchandise.
But listen
but again,
to this.
Again, that doesn't vindicate his behavior. We need the investigation,
it
but
doesn't.
What we need what we need immediately is to figure out what this budget's going to be and how this money's going to be spent. And
but
they
remember,
have to figure out a way to get along.
Everybody should remember that Cuomo is for the investigation. Why? Because obviously he needs the time.
It's a time. Yeah.
So if there's an investigation, the longer the better off that he is. Now, in terms of Stefanik, the gerrymanderers there is a special commission to do this in New York now. But the people who are thinking this through, the Democrats, are probably wondering whether it's better to leave her up there with that one district that goes forever. It's as big as the United States almost. Little sarcasm there, there's no question that if they put her in with single district with Claudia Tenney, which it looks like they will do, she'll be Claudia Tenney. Tenney has been there
in a primary.
Yes, she'll be.
Yeah, but then Brindisi is gonna, you know, the congressman, former assemblyman, and then a congressman for one term who lost by.
Yep.
Well, who knows how close it was, but
eight votes or whatever it is.
No,
votes,
that was in the one before, Joe. But this time he lost. Yeah. But
well, he lost
not by a lot.
Votes, but there were lots of contested votes. It was missed. It was botched. I mean, the whole thing was botched. But he accepted that he lost. He's going to come out strong. And if they redraw the district with a little more urban, content in it, you know, residents of urban areas and more Democratic areas. You know, it could be that whoever wins that primary will have a tough election. You know?
But why would they do that, Mike? That's the point. The whole philosophy here was to shove all the Republicans into one district.
Sure. I mean, I suppose, I suppose that's one way to sort of just isolate the problem and just let it fester there. Or the other is if they feel emboldened that they can actually go after somebody who they really can't stand.
Well, as I think the only person on this panel who has Elise Stefanik as their representative, I say I hope they do something.
What is that something, Joe? I mean, that's what we're discussing.
Well, I mean, you know, but to the point is, you know, we were in so for a long, long time we were in help me out, Mike, Jerry Solomon. We were in Jerry Solomon's district, and then when he retired, we went into we had Gillibrand.
John Sweeney.
That's right, Sweeney. You're right, John Sweeney.
And Gillibrand pulled off an upset.
Yes.
And unseated John Sweeney. But that district went all the way from Lake Placid down through, you know, your county, Rensselaer County, into parts of Dutchess County and across the river into Sullivan County. Now
but
they've redrawn it a little. Yeah.
But, Mike, there may be a little historiography on your part here. John Sweeney did some pretty bad things. You remember about the wife and the this and the that and the alcoholism that he was accused of. It was as if he was his worst own enemy.
Sure. I think it was a shock, though, that she was a new politician who suddenly came on the scene and rose to beat him in an election. But anyway, so it has gone back and forth. Then you had Chris Gibson.
Gibson.
And that was, he was very popular. You're right, Alan. He's a potential candidate, but I think he must like his new job as president at Siena College. So,
well, I must just say, whatever it's worth, I have, you know, been pushing Chris Gibson. I think he's terrific. I saw a letter yesterday which basically said, nope, I love being president of Siena, and I don't want anything to do with being brought into this at this point of the game. But I like you, Alan.
But not if you keep saying that.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll move on to other stuff. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. We have Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Rosemary Armeo and Mike Spain making up the group, and we do indeed welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Let's see. We just have a couple letters here on Cuomo, and then we'll move on. Adam says, I don't like it, but it looks to me that our culture frames women as consumables, so it does not surprise me that Cuomo or any other powerful man right now might feel entitled to consume. It does not surprise me that the population is not more upset. It grieves me. That from Adam. Jeff writes, the governor needs a fresh approach, acknowledge that he's a lonely 63-year-old man looking for a partner, and put out a call for volunteers who can send in their dating profile for initial evaluation. If there is a mutual interest, they can meet, go from there. He can continue to deny guilt in six cases while awaiting the investigation results. He may lose his governorship, but could gain the partner he's seeking without the criticism he's receiving now.
That's funny.
We'll go to new topic. Let's go to what is happening with the border. We talked a lot about this yesterday with Sarah Rogerson, but let us talk this morning as the president faces growing political threat from border upheaval. There's a representative of Modern Texas Republican Henry Kuehler, whose district hugs the border with Mexico, is unhappy with how President Biden's team has responded to the surge of migrants trying to enter the state. Quote, his people need to do a better job of listening to those of us who have done this before. Representative Kevin McCarthy was on the scene yesterday, the top House Republican. Made a trip to the border to slam Biden's approach. He was even more critical. There's no other way to claim it than a Biden border crisis, McCarthy said during a visit to a migrant processing center in El Paso. An immigration attorney who recently visited a detention site said that while the conditions there have greatly improved from the Trump era, it is unacceptable for children to be spending days on end in dramatically overcrowded facilities. Nearly 2 months into his first term, Biden faces a growing political threat from the upheaval at the border and is drawing criticism from across the spectrum. Centrist Democrats are nervous about attacks casting them as soft on border security. Liberals and immigration activists are sounding alarms about how migrants are treated, and Republicans are increasingly laying the groundwork for immigration-centric attacks in the midterm elections. Alan.
Well, we did discuss a good deal of this during the program. Those districts that are on the border are incredibly important politically. So, for example, Texas is showing more and more proximity to the Democrats than it had in the past. So the way this is going to be handled is going to be a very tough one on Joe Biden, and he is in a tough spot right now. You can't let everybody in. You can't even say you can't let everybody in. So I don't know what his answer is going to be. He can be nicer to the people who are coming over the border. He can give them dormitory rooms. He can give them food. He can try to take care of the kids. But it's a tough one.
Rosemary.
Well, I think that would go a long way, is to be nicer to those people. That's number one. My main objection to Trump was the cruelty of what he was doing. He also can lay out a plan and start actually acting on reform from top to bottom, reform of our immigration system. The Dreamers, the children, not just unaccompanied minors, but all the children and the families. What is asylum? It's a mess right now. He inherited that mess. He needs to make that clear in his messaging and begin a step-by-step approach to fixing it up, very similar to what he did with coronavirus. I've said all along I thought he was right to start with and concentrate on coronavirus, but it's becoming clear that this is not only a genuine crisis, but one that's being used against him politically. So now we need to see that second plan come into place. And it actually does play into everything else that he's interested in. It has an effect. Immigration and refugees coming in has an effect on handling of a coronavirus and spread of virus. It has a huge impact and as a result of climate change. So it makes sense that this is what he concentrates on now. And finally, raise sign the paperwork and raise the limit on refugees allowed into this country. I am unclear as to why he has not done that yet. He said he would. He has the power to. It's undisputed. Why has that not happened?
Teresa.
Well, I think Republicans are in search of an issue that they can coalesce around because obviously they're feeling the heat for not supporting the American Rescue Package and other things that are being well received, you know, the response to the pandemic. And one of the things that they can coalesce around is this border issue. And I think that they are going to exploit this border security issue as much as they possibly can, which will make it very difficult for the Biden administration to reach. I mean, immigration is a very complex issue to begin with, and the Republicans are just not going to want to get to yes on this because it's too politically helpful to them. And sadly, you know, that leaves children as pawns. These children are pawns to the smugglers or pawns to this political infighting, and, you know, it's a very difficult issue. But as Rosemary said, it's much larger than just the number of children coming across the border. I mean, there's a whole question about U.S. agriculture and its need for migrant farm workers, and there's no clear, coherent policy there. Universities need the students coming in. There's no clear policy position there. Scientific exchange. Companies need to hire people in the STEM fields. Families have been waiting to be reunited. So there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed. And also the economic situation in Central and South America. You know, what's at the root of driving this influx of immigrants? And these are really, really complex issues. And I think the Republicans are going to exploit them as opposed to trying to resolve them.
Mike Spain, last word before we take a break.
Yeah, I agree with what everyone is saying. It's a mess that he inherited, and it's a challenge to fix it, but he needs to do it. But it's important to also note that, you know, most of the people that come into the U.S. And do not have proper documentation are coming in all over the place. About 700,000 came in 2017 using visas and then just never showed up and never left. Nobody pays attention to that. And that exceeded that year the amount of people coming over the border by a whole lot. And you know, I think there's a real bias against people of brown skin, poor people coming over that border. And it's sickening. Trump has exploited it and scared people about it, you know, the bad hombre thing. And I think we have to look at it a lot more compassionately, and I think Biden will.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll get your letters on this subject and others, plus we'll move on to other things. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Mike Spain, and Teresa Bourgeois on the program this morning. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Mike Spain. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We've been talking about the border and Biden's handling of that, President Biden's handling. We do have some letters. Let's go to those, and then we'll move on to other stuff. We go to Ruth, who says, as you debate Biden's support and commitment to women, please do not forget the Violence Against Women Act, because many women who are victims of domestic violence certainly have not. Thank you. We go to Peter. The new, quote-unquote, new immigration crisis is no more than an issue the Trumpists are using to divert attention from the numerous successes of the new, shouty caps, Biden administration. Don't give it oxygen. Furthermore, we all know that this issue predates the Biden administration. Do not repeat this right-wing talking point used by Trump nativist supporters, not that they even know who the nativists were. So are we not supposed to report about what's happening on the border? Is that Rosemary?
Well, we certainly have to, and it certainly affects the way in which this country is comprised and composed, and who's going to be here and who's going to be helping the farmers and who's going to be, you know, taking up needed resources. Look, this is a major debate, and of course we have to be talking about it.
Let's see. Carolyn says the Republican playbook is all about the new Newt Gingrich philosophy of hit them on any weak spot, they could care less about the humans trying to live safely. Teresa is right. And Andrew says that my pronunciation of the congressman's name is not correct. It is Cuellar. And I have no idea what I even said. So there we go. So I won't even try to repeat it. I'll just say that he is absolutely right. It's Cuellar. Okay. We will go now to a story that we mentioned early on, and that was the vaccine. AstraZeneca concerns throw Europe's vaccine rollout into deeper disarray. Germany, France, Italy, Spain become the latest countries to suspend use of the vaccine, even as a third wave of the pandemic threatens the continent. As this third wave crashes over Europe, questions about the safety of one of the continent's most commonly available vaccines led Germany, France, Italy, and Spain to temporarily halt its use on Monday. The suspensions created further chaos and inoculation rollouts, even as new coronavirus variants continue to spread. The decisions followed reports that a handful of people who had received the vaccine made by AstraZeneca had developed fatal brain hemorrhages and blood clots. The company has strongly defended its vaccine, saying there is, quote, no evidence of increased risk of blood clots or hemorrhages among more than 17 million people who have received the shot in the European Union and the United Kingdom. AstraZeneca said in a statement Monday, the safety is our first priority. We are working with national health authorities and European officials and look forward to their assessment later this week. The timing of the pause in inoculations by some of Europe's biggest countries, which followed a flurry of similar actions by Denmark, Norway, and others, could not have been worse. Europe's vaccine rollouts already lag far behind those in Britain and the United States. And there is a dawning realization that much of the continent is suffering a third wave of infections. That from the New York Times. Alan. Mike.
I'm here. I'm trying to manage ringing phones, turning down the pod, and getting back to you. And I thank you. I thank you for your attention. And
technological twister going on.
And remind me of the question again, Joe. Really?
Yes. We were talking about. you can pass to later if you want. But we're talking about AstraZeneca. And
I have plenty of thoughts on that. First of all. Remember that we don't have AstraZeneca being distributed in the United States, which gives me a little faith in the people who are making these decisions, right? So I think that that's a positive. The second is I'm listening with great interest to the fact that the AstraZeneca people are saying the incidence of blood clots in the people we're talking to isn't greater than the incidence of blood clots in the general population. That's got to make you think a little bit. And, you know, the fact is that they're going with what it is, what they have in these countries. And, you know, again, they don't have the other stuff. So they're going with what they got. It seems to me I understand that.
Teresa.
Well, in reading this, it's difficult for me to know who to believe in this situation. What I found interesting, I mean, clearly the COVAX folks, those are the people who are purchasing to deliver to poor countries. And they have invested heavily in AstraZeneca, the World Health Organization, for the COVAX efforts. They have invested heavily, heavily in AstraZeneca, and so they're sticking with it. But what's odd to me is that they talked about the fact that that theirs is being manufactured in India and South Korea, not being manufactured in Europe, as if it's something different. So I don't understand that at all. I think it is AstraZeneca aside, what's happening in Europe, the uptick in cases should be a warning for what's going on in the United States, because this could happen again. And I think, Alan, the U.S. is not right now using but has purchased AstraZeneca, have they not?
Beats me.
Yeah, I don't. I don't,
AstraZeneca hasn't applied yet for CD, or, you know, for FDA approval, but they were expected to when they were rolling it out in Europe. But their commitments were to supplying countries in Europe first, so it was, you know, it was going to roll out, and now I suppose it's a good thing if the FDA, the U.S. FDA, which is gaining back credibility, were to vet this application and find that it's safe. I think it would be very helpful around the world too, not just here.
And some of the countries that are moving ahead with it seem to be making the calculation, yes, it is causing some deaths, but overall, the benefits outweigh the risks. And I'm not sure how best one makes that calculation, but that seems to be the calculation.
Now, I don't think that's right. I think they are accepting the science that says statistically the same number of people that have suffered brain hemorrhages mm-hmm. who've had the vaccine is equivalent to those who haven't had the vaccine. And brain hemorrhages are an occurrence in a large population, and that it's no different. And if you accept science, but people are not accepting science these days. Have you noticed?
Yeah, some people. Some
an
people.
Issue, yeah. Rosemary.
Well, the poll disturbed me.
Okay,
sorry.
So,
the poll.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Rosemary, and then we'll go back to Teresa. Go ahead.
So the worst job in the world right now is PR for AstraZeneca. This is a huge problem for them. If that drug were being offered in the United States, I would not get it, even though I understand the whole thing about how 39 cases out of several million is not statistically sound. I'm ever grateful to be in the United States where I have a choice of using other products. And I compare that to a very good friend in Bosnia who went into the hospital with both of her elderly parents this week. Two of them are on ventilators because there are no vaccines in Bosnia. None. Zero. Nobody's being vaccinated. In that case, yes, AstraZeneca, totally I would have gotten it. But it's it is a problem of perception and vaccine resistance. And even in this country where we're not even using that, as I've said, it still gives credence to the idea that the vaccine is somehow even more dangerous than the disease that Democrats have turned into a boogeyman. So I think it's extremely unfortunate, and I don't think AstraZeneca is handling it right from a public relations point of view. Yes, the science is on their side, and nobody's paying attention to that because they're worried, and that needs to be addressed. I don't think they are.
Teresa, back to you. You were talking about polling.
Well, I read a poll last night that 49% of Republican males don't want to get vaccinated. If that's true, that has to be turned around somehow. That's really, really dangerous for the country.
Yeah, I saw another poll that said 42% of Republicans who support Trump are not planning to get the vaccine, and 90% of Democrats are planning to get the vaccine. So, but if it plateaus around 60%, we may not reach herd immunity, some doctors, some experts are saying. And, what people fail to realize is that getting a vaccine not only protects the person who gets the vaccine, it protects all the vulnerable people they might come in contact with. And it's just tragically sad that there is this political divide over something that makes so much sense.
Yeah, and it doesn't stop there, Mike. The confusion that we are being fed in terms of what the variances are and whether or not they will the stuff that we are facing will be taken care of by the present vaccine that we're getting. So that's gotta have a lot of people scratching their heads also. I know that's not very articulate what I just said, but I think there are a lot of reasons that people worry about this stuff.
Go ahead, Teresa.
One of my concerns, too, is if the World Health Organization is relying primarily on AstraZeneca for the COVAX efforts, those in poorer countries, as Rosemary just well points out what that means on the ground, and if, in fact, AstraZeneca becomes a problem, then what happens to that very essential global vaccination effort? I mean, this this needs to be addressed, either determine that it's okay or there needs to be an alternative, because for humanitarian reasons, for, you know, it's a, we really need to have vaccinations all over the world.
So
one of the many bad things that Trump did was to throw shade on and withdraw from WHO. This, Teresa is so right. This is a global pandemic. That means you don't have America first. It doesn't even help America to go first, because we can get reinfected. And development of the vaccine, distribution of the vaccine, protection and checks and studies should have been global, and could have been. We have the mechanism for it, and he withdrew from that, and has made it really difficult to go back. Everybody's now on their own path. I think that's just one more, chalk that up to one more bad thing he did in handling this crisis.
Rosemary, I want to go back to something that you said a moment ago when you were talking about this and of not wanting to be a PR person for AstraZeneca, which may, you know, may be worse this week, but probably still as bad as being a press person for Buckingham Palace. However, I am curious as to what the idea of taking a break for 3 days, obviously that takes, you know, in a country where we're vaccinating over a million five a day, that obviously takes its toll, number one. Number two, how do you, for want of a better term, wish away this very concerning problem in just a matter of days?
If you're talking about it just from the PR point of view, I don't think the break is a bad idea at all. It's acknowledging that we have at least the perception of a major problem and we're taking it seriously. I would go back over every study I have on blood clots. I would make sure, and of course, if it's favorable, that that this gets out to the public. Here's what's really happening on blood clots or brain bleeds. I would look at the cases of those people and worldwide, every person who has died, and I would know what the story was on all of them. Is there something else complicating it? Was there something in common among those people? Does it turn out that if you have some sort of blood type, or, you know what I'm talking about? What is what's the thing in common among those people who have this fatal reaction to the vaccine? That needs to be known. And I don't know at this point if they're speaking from a PR or scientific point of view, when they say, oh, no, this is the same thing as in a regular population, has nothing to do with the vaccine. Is that proven? So I would be, as a public relations person, I would be damn sure I had that information, and then I would act accordingly to it. And it may be, if there is no connection, if there really is a serious increase or a danger, boy, I'd be thinking about, you know, what I really want to do. I don't think it's just this one drug. I think right. that fear is so great that it could influence people getting all kinds of vaccines, not just AstraZeneca's.
Yeah, I just don't know what you tell most of Europe to have them say, okay, we're going to renew, you know, we're going to take it off pause and start giving people this medicine again. Teresa.
Well, it was interesting to me in one of the articles, I think it was the Washington Post, I'm not sure, but the relevant medical society, the International Society on Thrombosis, they say that they recommend adults continue to use a vaccine because, quote, the small number of reported thrombotic events relative to the millions of administered COVID-19 vaccinations does not suggest a direct link. So, you know, I don't know the science here, but the relevant International Medical Association says there's not a direct link. But as Rosemary well points out, whether there is or not, there's now a stigma, and that's going to, I think, reduce people's willingness to use the vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think the public perception is always going to prevail over what the actual science is. And we unfortunately live in a time when we have come to really distrust science. I don't know if the data that you just read, Teresa, is sufficient. I mean, but I trust that it is, because I trust organizations that have credibility. But when you knock the credibility down, when you start pointing fingers at who's to blame for this, pandemic, and withdraw from worldwide organizations, you undermine the credibility, and this is now coming home to roost. People are skeptical.
Joe, we had a letter from another Joe who said, if Republicans do not get vaccinated, there will be less Republicans. Maybe Republicans should realize this. Wait a second. You know,
that's
if Republicans...
Wait
a second.
They said it aloud.
Yeah, right. That's just terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, let's face it. You know, people, if it's out there, people are going to get it. And it doesn't matter whether you're Republicans or Democrats, it's going to get spread. So I understand there's a little sarcasm involved in this, but best not do it.
Mark says the Republicans' response to the humanitarian crisis of thousands of poor, desperate children at our border seeking help, Leader McCarthy, blaming them for rising COVID cases, smacks of hypocrisy. A pro-lifer again showing he only cares about unborn children, a maskless leader who never complained about COVID while attending Trump's super spreader rallies blaming children for spreading COVID, and in a state where all restrictions were lifted. Democrats must learn how to do a better job of letting the Republicans control the narrative. That from Mark. This letter from Peter. The migrants attempting to enter the U.S. along the southern border have uprooted their families, left... Whoops. The letter mysteriously disappeared. I will read from Erica's letter. Okay, while I get a clear public service message about getting a vaccine is important, I'm getting a little sick of it. I don't know what more can be done. The science is there. Millions have been vaccinated, and they haven't dropped dead. The idea you should be convinced of getting it is ridiculous. If you think you know better than every single professional in the field, then don't take it. Remember, 60 million of us can still get it, and we will reach herd immunity. That from Erica. We go to Brian, who said, do you think President Biden should ask former President Bush to assist with the border crisis? Bush tried unsuccessfully to push immigration reform, but was stymied by the Tea Party, understands and is empathetic to the issue, speaks Spanish, and can give Biden political cover in Texas. Alan, what do you think about that?
Well, I think to some degree that's happening. I mean, I think quite clearly when the Trump wars were on, the Bushes were on the side of rational thinking. They did provide an awful lot of backup. And their people, you could tell, even though sometimes, you know, George Bush wouldn't say anything, W. Bush would say anything, his people were saying things. And they wouldn't have been out there unless the Bushes were horrified by what was going on with Trump. I think we got to give them a little credit.
The letter that disappeared as I was reading it was from Peter. The migrants attempting to enter the U.S. along the southern border have uprooted their families, left their homes, and traveled long, dangerous routes to escape the corruption and violence associated with illegal drug trafficking organizations. Guess which country has the greatest demand for those illegal drugs? Yes, the United States. That from Peter.
Yeah, and it should be added, too, that a lot of these people are leaving Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, because the governments there are brutal, and they don't enforce the laws in there. And the reason that one of the big reasons that these governments are so brutal is because they have strong allies of the U.S. who back the current leaders over reformers. And I mean that's a 30, 40, 50, 60 year problem. We really have to help these countries get better. I mean, they're not coming from Costa Rica, where they have a very, positive democracy going on. They're coming from the poor countries that have been kept poor by U.S. foreign policy.
I mean, you and Rosemary both made this point. I mean, it's a longstanding problem that's been going on for decades. And yet you see, and I know Sarah Rogerson was saying this yesterday, of the cyclical nature of it, and yet it continues to be a political issue to the point where we get letters like, why are you giving this air? It's just a Republican trope. But it is happening. There are people at the border, and there are children who are unaccompanied who are there, and it has to be addressed, right? I mean, it seems like something that is okay, it may come back over and over again, but it's still something that has to be dealt with.
Yeah, I agree. I asked I asked Bob earlier, or I guess last week when we first began talking about this, is this really a crisis, or is this the Republicans right. calling a situation that's existed forever a crisis? And he made, I thought, a compelling argument that, no, this is really different. And that means, yes, the press needs to be there, covering it with floodlights on it. And as I say, I think that immigration is tied intimately to crisis, the crisis in the climate, which puts pressure on governments, many of them corrupt, to allocate resources, as Alan is always talking about. And there's nothing more that the press should be covering than this. And that doesn't indicate a bias on either side. And I don't think there's any dispute that our policy right now is a mess. It's after years under Trump of being boiled into confusion and anger. We just don't have a clear picture. It would be so nice to have some clear minds and level heads sitting down and saying, okay, here are some things we could do. I don't see that happening, but I wish for it.
We'll stop there for a moment. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll do our final round with our panel this morning. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Mike Spain. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this news from the BBC. Our last go round together is a panel this morning, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Mike Spain making up the panel. So I'm going to merge two stories together here, and we can discuss. Federal authorities have arrested and charged two men with assaulting U.S. Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick with an unknown chemical spray during the January 6th Capitol riot, but have not determined whether the exposure caused his death. Julian Cotter, 32 years old, of Pennsylvania, and George Tenios of West Virginia were taken into custody on Sunday. Authorities said they grew up together in New Jersey. And they have a video where the two were talking to each other, where one asked the other for the spray. About 9 minutes later, after that he had been sprayed with something, one man is seen on the video discharging a canister of toxic substance into the face of Sicknick and two other officers, according to the arrest papers. So they're each charged with 9 counts, including assaulting 3 officers with a deadly weapon. Meanwhile, in another universe, Ron Johnson, the Wisconsin senator, tried to explain his comments about being more scared had Black Lives Matter followers storm the Capitol. Senator Johnson yet again caused controversy by saying what he really thought about the January 6th Capitol riot, having previously downplayed the severity of it and raised a debunked conspiracy theory that it might not have been perpetrated by supporters of Donald Trump. Johnson said he never truly felt threatened. His reason, because in his words, those are people that love this country, that truly respect law enforcement, would never do anything to break the law. He said he would have felt more threatened if Black Lives Matter or Antifa were behind the riot. On Monday, as the Washington Post puts it, Johnson kept digging. In an appearance on a local Wisconsin radio show, Johnson fought back against allegations of racism for invoking Black Lives Matter and saying he would have been more scared if that movement had been behind it. So there are, again, two stories merged together. Alan, what do you think?
Let me say something in my most professorial way.
Yes, sir.
Which is, what a pig. You know, Johnson is. I mean, this is just unbelievable pandering to the know-nothing crowd in Wisconsin. As you know, I'm a student of Wisconsin politics and wrote a book about it. And yes. When you're on the outside...
But the legislature, right? Am
yeah,
I right
yeah,
on that?
The legislature, yeah. But the whole political... Yeah. Area, yeah, that's right. And thank you for that clarification.
I was asking for a plug of the title is ultimately what I was fishing for.
Yeah, right. The Wisconsin legislature, and I have to say, you can look it up under Shartok. It's very old now, very, very old. But what I was trying to say was that the way in which Wisconsin politics works is the Democrats can be, not always are, but can be very, very left, and the Republicans can be off the moon. And that's what we're finding with Johnson. And that hasn't changed since I wrote about the Wisconsin legislature. So, you know, it is just unbelievable that that guy can look in a mirror. It's that simple. Anyway, off to somebody else now.
Ron Johnson said, "I completely did not anticipate that anybody could possibly interpret what I said as racist." Mike?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll just point out one thing. While he said he wouldn't feel that these people were truly lovers of our country and respect law enforcement, authorities said 139 police officers were assaulted by those supporters of Trump. You know, some had sledgehammers and baseball bats and hockey sticks and crutches. And in this case, for Brian Sicknick, it was a can of bear spray, which I guess is a lot more painful and damaging than mace, you know, and pepper right. spray. And I mean, he'll wink, you know, you can almost see him winking when he's a race baiter. He makes a comment that's racist, then says, "Whoa, no, I didn't mean anything like that." And he kind of smiles, you know, he's toxic. He's a toxic guy.
Rosemary.
I'm glad that the mystery of Officer Sitnick's death is now being addressed. It's, we've gone such a long time without knowing what really happened. And in fact, the autopsy report is still not out. There's no direct charges related to his death because there's been no ruling of homicide. And it's been days and days and days. I find that really extraordinary and odd, but I'm glad they are pursuing it. And as for Johnson, I think he's toast anyway. I don't believe in managing problems that are going to go away. I think he is going to be the number one target of the Democrats when the next elections come up. And I don't think he's going to make it, and nor does he deserve to. I'm not sure what's more stupid, what he said, saying he would be afraid of Black Lives Matter protesters, but not of those armed insurrectionists who were mostly white. Or then saying, "Oh no, there's nothing racist about that," right? Yeah. And I mean, that's just like an affront to his voters, to the intelligence level of his voters. It's just ridiculous. So I'm glad that he's getting a lot of blowback from that.
Well, you better hope, Rosemary. You better hope that he is not being well received by a larger segment of that Wisconsin population than you may be giving credit to. Do you know what I'm saying here?
I don't think that he would have been on a Wisconsin radio station saying the stupid rollback things that he was trying to say if he were really getting lots of you go boy letters from his constituents. Don't believe it. I who have lost so much faith in the American voter after 2016 cannot believe that of people in Wisconsin.
Well, this jerk got elected as a United States Senator, didn't he?
Teresa, you were going to say?
Yeah, well, I think actually what Senator Johnson's saying is a reflection of a larger effort by Republicans, conservative Republicans, particularly conservative talk radio, Fox, others, to rewrite the history of what happened on January 6th at the Capitol. And I believe that the Saturday comments were on the national talk radio, the PAGS, you know, Joe Pagliarulo, whatever his name is. I thought that was the program was on. But and I think that they're also trying to, you know, rewrite the laws on voting to suppress, you know, voter suppression all around the country. And I think both of those are a ongoing threat to, you know, they're an assault on our democracy and an ongoing threat to a democracy. And we really need to listen very carefully. I listen to a lot of conservative talk radio just to try to understand what's going on. And while they don't often say the quiet parts out loud, the really racist stuff out loud, this notion of what happened on the 6th is talked about on conservative radio in a very different way, as a conspiracy theory against them. And you know, the whole "we love the police" theme is pretty consistent in it. despite what you can see with your own eyes when you look at the video. I think it's really deeply disturbing and a much bigger problem.
I want to go back to something Rosemary said a few moments ago, which I think is a really good point, that we're finally seeing some, I mean, obviously the investigation was going on to the into the death of Officer Sicknick, but it seems a long time since we really heard anything, right, Rosemary, of anything substantive as what happened to these officers and, as Mike mentioned, of the many other officers who were abused in the process.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, they still haven't released the autopsy on Sicknick, and it gets complicated. But the fact is, there was not any regard for police officers, and even though there were some current and former police officers and military people in the crowd, clearly that's been identified by the FBI. They were attacking and injuring and doing terrible things. One lost an eye. Others have suffered all kinds of concussions and things. These are not people who respect law and order. Let's say that.
I mean, clearly they're taking this seriously because 300 people have been arrested and charged and more than 40 people accused of assaulting police officers. But I just have to wonder what the reaction, the national reaction, would have been if African-American protesters, Black Lives Matter protesters, sprayed bear spray at police officers and one of them died, or if they were seen in video holding the, you know, poles that American flags or Trump flags were attached to, beating police officers. My guess is there would be a different level of national outrage.
You know, we have another case here where the media has been covering this well, but still the message is not getting across. There was violence related to Black Lives Matter protests, but there were thousands more people involved in those protests over a much wider time period and area in the United States than that insurrection. And that seems to all be lost. To equate Black Lives Matter protesting and some sporadic violence there to the intended intense violence in Washington on January 6th is ridiculous. And it's part of, as Teresa has said, this retelling of the story of that day. Oh, I wasn't really afraid. Why wasn't he? Everybody else was, and indeed Republican lawmakers, Mitt Romney for one, were endangered. Mike Pence for another were truly endangered that day. So why wasn't he afraid? It's not a story that bears any kind of examination.
And why isn't there collective outrage on this, Republican and Democratic alike? And why has Pence been completely silent, absolutely deafeningly silent about what happened? It's just unbelievable to me. There should be collective outrage about what happened in our Capitol on January 6th, and there's not. And it's really deeply concerning to our democracy.
Alan, any thoughts on Pence?
No, I think I've been listening intently, and I think everything people have been saying is exactly right now on Pence. Look, hope springs eternal. This guy may think in his own mind. There are two thoughts I had on this. One, he may think in his own mind, if he plays his cards right, he's going to be the candidate. If Trump is caught up in his legal issues and the rest of it, that he, Pence, will put himself forward and he may get the Republican nomination. But I also think that Pence knows that the president, the former president, knows all about him, probably has some stuff on him that he doesn't want out there. So he's got to be very careful, despite the fact that his own life was threatened. It's unbelievable.
But, Alan, I don't disagree with you that Pence may make the calculation that it's politically expedient to be silent about this. Right. But why is that the calculation? I mean, why is it that we don't have a collective outrage about police officers being beaten with flags and being sprayed with bear spray and with U.S. senators, Republicans and Democrats alike, life being threatened? I mean, if we can't all get together and agree that that's a bad thing, it's really a problem for our democracy.
Well, you see Ron Johnson and you see this former vice president ignoring all of that. In their own self-interest, they think that if they do that, that they can advance themselves. So you ask in a wonderful way, Teresa, you know, why? And the answer is, that's why.
All right. Last word. We have to go. We're out of time. Alan, thank you very much. Thank you to Rosemary, Teresa, and Mike. We'll be back right after this.